Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Campus Program webinar series. I'm Livia Rojas. I'm the Training and Resource Coordinator in the Campus Program at the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also known as CALCASA. And this webinar is part of the Campus Program web conference series, which serves as technical assistance for recipients of the U.S. DOJ OVW grant to reduce sexual assault, domestic violence, dating violence, and stalking on campus across the United States, Guam, and Puerto Rico. So today's webinar will start shortly, and we're just going to go really briefly over the agenda. And as you can see, we're going to go, review the campus technical assistance team. We know that there's been a lot of changes, as happened with our campuses in terms of project directors and folks that end up attending these web conferences. So it's always good to get a sense of, just to remind folks of the different roles that the campus technical assistance team provides to all the campuses. And we'll also briefly review today's technology. We know most folks are familiar with iLink, but it's always good just to do a little refresher. And then we'll segue into just a few announcements that we have. And right after, we'll continue with the with today's web conference training that will be led by Dr. Derek Lane, and that is addressing communication with trainees to enhance the training impact. And, of course, there will be a Q&A session followed right after. And before we end, we, of course, acknowledge and give our extend our gratitude to everyone for making today's web conference possible. So having said that, I just wanted to do a really quick shout out to a few more folks that are joining us. So greetings to saludos a las compañeras y compañeros at the University of Puerto Rico. So we do have folks out of Puerto Rico joining us as well. And we also have some more colleagues joining us from the Northeast, Sarah Caldwell, Connecticut College, and Sonia over at East Central University in Oklahoma. So having said that, we're just going to move right into the brief overview of the TA team. So as most of you know, the TA team is split up. We have each organization that's two right now that's represented per So each organization is responsible for providing technical assistance to all the campuses on one of the four minimum requirements. So we have with CALCASA, this is Denise Labertu. She's the new director of advocacy and campus services at CALCASA. So Denise, if you're online, please let us know. And if you don't mind quickly introducing yourself to folks.
I am on the line. Hi, Livia. Hi, everybody. I'm really excited to be working in this capacity now with CALCASA and the opportunity to work with you all, also with Livia, just so that you all know the littlest bit about me, and that is that I've worked in the field of sexual assault advocacy and domestic violence advocacy for over 17 years, working with many campuses, and actually I'm faculty on a few locally. So I really am looking forward to the opportunity to work more closely with each of you and to learn about all your experiences on campuses. So thanks a lot, Livia, for your leadership in this, and I look forward to continued contact with everyone.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Denise, and it is really exciting to have a director. But it's also incredibly exciting to really kind of continue with this venture that is the campus program and seeing how we are evolving in terms of improving the technical assistance that we provide to everybody. So excited to have Denise joining us. And Denise will also be meeting the TA providers that are on the team in a couple months. And the other TA provider providers are Leah Lyon. She's the director of technical assistance over at East Central Oklahoma University. And then we also have Dorothy Edwards, and she's the director of the mandatory education component. It is Dorothy works alongside Jennifer Sayer, who's the director of training and development. And then we also have Althea and Lavette Johnson, and they are both wonderful colleagues over at the Mississippi Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So our colleagues at the Mississippi Coalition oversee the judicial affairs policy component or minimum requirement. And I think I forgot to mention this, Leah Lyon oversees the law enforcement training. So we'll just move on to the next slide, which is the technology. So really briefly, folks, just to see if this works, if at the top left hand corner of your screen, there should be a hand or a palm where it says My Status. Click on that and just select where it says Raise Hand, just so I know that folks Great. So we have some folks that are humoring me. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. And so this is just one way of getting our attention. So as you know, most of you know, I will generally kind of moderate the discussion and try to get any questions posed by grantees that are using the text chat. As always, during the training, we do encourage folks to post questions. And if for whatever reason Derek doesn't catch any or some of them, raising your hand is another way of getting our attention. And just going to the text chat box, it looks like just about everybody knows how to use it, but just as a refresher, there are two tabs. There's the public tab at the lower left-hand corner of your screen, and the public tab is where you get to engage in a public discussion with everybody. So what you type is what everybody ends up seeing. If, however, you want to just chat with one other individual, you want to hit that private tab and then double-click on the name of that person that you'd like to have a conversation with. So again, raise the hand or use the text chat to get our attention if you have a question. We did actually provide folks with the opportunity to unmute their lines in the event that their question is really complex and nuanced and they feel that, just typing it out isn't enough for them. So having said that, we'll move on. This is just me showing off that I can use graphics. So, all right then. Great. So just moving on before we start, just wanted to do a really brief round of announcements. So as I said before, today's web conference started. All of the webinar materials are made available on calcasa.org. So right now, if you dare leave this web conference, you can actually go to your internet browser, go to calcasa.org, and what you'll see there is a blog post that has today's presentation in a PDF format along with a handout, which is a model that you'll see featured in today's presentation. And then the recording will not be made available for at least another 2 days. But once that recording is up and running, we'll make that available to folks, and we'll send out a reminder on the project director listserv, in addition to a copy of the text chat transcription from today's web conference. So the other announcement we'd like to make is the next and last web conference in the series. It's going to be on Tuesday, October 23rd, and, of course, it's set at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. And that training topic is going to be on judicial affairs or policy. So that means the Mississippi Coalition will be leading that one. And we will be sending out the registration information and the specific topic and the presenter info within the next couple of weeks. So, and again, that will be announced both via listserv, blog post, Twitter, and Facebook. And then lastly, just a reminder, the Campus Institute is going to be held the week of January 21st. I'm not sure if we actually had formally announced that, but do hold that week. Again, the exact date and dates will vary as it depends on which institute you are attending. So just a reminder, there are four different institutes that occur simultaneously. And so I think it'll be good for folks to kind of at least know that that's the date that you want to reserve so you can get your team going. Fantastic. So at this point, I just wanted to, pretty much hand it over to Derek. But before we start, I just wanted to say that we're really excited to have Derek Lane joining us today. He will be, as I've mentioned, he's going to be addressing communication training with trainees to enhance the training impact on for folks that are working to end sexual violence on college and university campuses. So just a really brief introduction to who Derek is. Derek Lane is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Kentucky, who earned his PhD in communication from the University of Oklahoma. He's an active researcher with the University of Kentucky Institute for HIV, STD, and Pregnancy Prevention, where he is responsible for curriculum design that implements several individual difference variables. His expertise and professional training encompasses specialty areas, which include team building, mediation, negotiation and conflict management, leadership, communication skills, training, and development, technological innovations in organizations, and business and professional speaking. Clearly, Derek Lane knows his stuff. So, having said that, I will hand it over to Derek at this point. Thank you, Derek.
Very good. Thank you, Livia. And thank you all for joining me today. I can't wait to share this with you. I know that trying to cover everything with respect to trainees and training impact is like trying to nail Jell-O to a tree. Now, as it turns out, it's possible to do that. And you can see here with the right nailing gun, I can make it stick to a tree. But we've got a couple of objectives that are important today, and there's six of them in particular that we're going to accomplish over the time that we have. Please keep in mind that if anybody has any questions, post them as we go, and I will deal with them as they come up. Plus, we'll have Q&A at the end. So again, welcome. First thing I want to do is to show you what I mean by a message-centric approach to training. Then we're going to look at what I think are the major factors that influence training efficacy before we look at the communication features that I believe have the strongest impact on the training itself. From there, then, we'll move into looking at how to increase training engagement around the issues of whatever the training is, whether it be Green Dot or some other program that you have in place. Then we'll look at the relationship between trainer competencies and training engagement. And then finally, we'll look at how you actually communicate that engaging content to the trainees. So I want you to begin by just thinking, this is just a rhetorical question, but I want you to think about your most driving question or concern when you deal with trainees. Maybe it's their, it could be their level of motivation. It could be their level of readiness. It could be worrying about the questions that they might ask that you don't have an answer to. Whatever those questions are, think about that. And that's really what brought about this training to begin with. Some people call it the Dorothy factor, and for those of you that know Dorothy or have seen her train, you'll know what I'm talking about. People will have a training program and they say, well, this works really well for this trainer or that trainer, but it doesn't work for me because maybe I don't have the same extroversion or I don't have the same dynamic delivery. And what I want to do is I want to show you through these communication elements the primary components of the Dorothy factor. So how do you deliver dynamic training that makes a profound impact on the trainees? In doing that, I'm going to start by looking at the model that I hope everybody has had a chance to download. From there, we'll look at especially knowledge acquisition and knowledge application and change. That's really what's important. And then from there, we'll move right into looking at the six big strategies that everybody can learn to improve in their trainings that will make, I think, a huge difference. So we start by looking at the model, and for most of you, this is where we want to focus, right here on the knowledge application. Some trainings, though, think that it's good enough just to give people the necessary knowledge, and I'm going to challenge you all to take it to the next step and say knowledge acquisition is necessary, but it's not sufficient. From there, then, knowing that that's the goal, we're going to focus today on these issues, the trainer caring, the credibility, and the immediacy. But before we do that, I want you to consider the message-centric components. You'll notice that the acronym is CORE, and what we're looking at is every training should be clear, optimal, relevant, and essential. Let me talk about what those are just real quick. When we talk about clear, that I think is self-explanatory. The messages need to be, and there's three different kinds of clarity that I'm going to talk about, but it's important that everybody knows what it is that you're trying to do, and I'll give you some strategies for making sure the training does that. Thanks, Olivia, for posting where that model's available. When we talk about optimal levels, we're talking about not talking down to the trainees. In other words, you don't want to talk over their head by using acronyms and alphabet soup. On the other hand, you don't want to talk down to them as if they're children, and that's what I mean by optimal. It needs to be cognitively challenging, but not so much that it's over or under the individuals. Then we move into relevance. How do we make training relevant? I hope that for all of you, you're thinking about how you might take the content that I'm talking about today, that I hope I didn't overpromise in the title, and that you'll be able to take this and use it yourself. And then finally, when we talk about essential, and this is really difficult for people, essential training content is content that comes from the table of contents rather than what comes from the index. I know we believe everything is critical and everything is important, but at the end of the day, most trainings are only so long, so you need to make sure that you've provided the most essential content, okay? Then beyond that, there are some things to consider about the trainees, and we all know that they all have certain intellectual potential, that they bring prior knowledge, some of which is inaccurate to our trainings, and they have different levels of motivation for being there on that day, okay? So all those things are important. Hi, Dorothy. Dorothy just came in. She says hi to everybody. Hi, everybody. All right. So what we're going to do then is I want you to know that while those training components are important, it's also critical that at the end of the day, you're talking about engagement and efficacy. How can you improve their ability to want to do something so that they believe they have the capacity to do it? And then ultimately, how do you get them to use the content? If all you're doing is being a talking head, we're going to have trouble, because ultimately, at the end of the day, all they're going to remember is the knowledge acquisition, and they won't ever get to the application. All right, so that's enough on the model right now, but those are the essential elements of what I'm calling the message-centric approach to training. So from there, I just want to briefly touch on the trainee characteristics. When I talk about intellectual potential, in many ways I'm talking about the self-esteem that they're bringing to the training. We have students, for example, that will enter our engineering program, and they don't really feel like they're ready, simply because maybe their high school classes only went through algebra 2 or geometry. It has nothing to do with their ability, but their self-esteem is actually it factors into that whole equation. When we talk about training prior knowledge, we're really just talking about how much of what they bring to us is accurate and how much of it is inaccurate and has to be relearned. You know, when you're doing Green Dot, for example, and you've got that training, and you hear somebody say something crazy like, well, they shouldn't have been out walking around at 2 o'clock at night, that's information that you have to correct on the spot, because that's part of the engagement you're wanting them to change. If you can change those scripts, you can change the way they interact with others. And I think ultimately that's what we're looking at. And then finally, we have different levels of state motivation. People today are part of this webinar. If you're on the West Coast, it's 11 o'clock in the morning. If you're on the East Coast, it's already quarter after 2. So we all have different motivation that we bring to the table, and you have to consider that in your trainings. Now, let me give you an example. Here I've got a little picture of ELF, and let's say that I'm asking you as trainers to solve for E, L, F, and O. So you look at that, and I pose the question, how do you start? What are you going to do? Voice is back on. Was it off? Okay, so Libby's having some trouble coming in and out. What a lot of people would do is they'd sit here and they'd go through each section of numbers. You know, so you're asking the trainees to come up with something out of the blue, and they look at this and they say, well, if E is 1 and L is 1 and F is 1, then that's 111 plus 111. Well, that's going to take them forever. If what you're doing as a trainer is providing some kind of a structure that the trainees can put the content in, it's a lot better. So let's say, for example, that we think of the largest three-digit number that we know. Let's say it's 999. And if we added 999 to 999, we would never get a number such that F was greater than 1. F has to be 1. If we know that, then if I add F to F, L has to be 2. If I add 2 to 2, I get 4. And so now what you find is, if you're adding, and again, it's just a matter of strategies. It's just a matter of going through. In this case, I know that E is 7, L is 2, F is 1. Right? My point is this. Even though what we're training has nothing to do with this equation or this problem-solving activity, we're all asking trainees to work outside their comfort zones. And it's important that we remember that as trainers. So one of the ways that you can get people involved is give them shared control. And I'll show you that here in the model. We'll flip back to that slide just real quick. But what you're going to see is if you give them the opportunity, bless you, to ask questions along the way, to clarify. If we were in a room and we were going ELF plus ELF equals fool, there'd be a lot of questions and there'd be a lot of faces looking at me like, what are you asking about? What are you trying to do? Okay? The other thing you have to do is give them confidence to ask the questions, make it safe, but do as much as you can in the content to give them the efficacy. So maybe you have a participant who says, you know, I really don't feel comfortable walking outside my role as bystander. I just assume not say anything. That's when you say to them, it's okay if you don't feel like you can intervene directly. You know, why don't you just ask them if they can borrow your cell phone or ask a friend to call for help? You don't have to get involved directly, but you need to do something. And then ultimately, you want to make sure that you give your trainees an opportunity to use those trained behaviors. Okay? These are all critical pieces. So we go back to the model, and you'll notice that this blue area is the area that I'm talking about. Give them an opportunity to share control, to come up with their own examples if need be. Now, if your training is so important and you haven't essentialized so that you've got 500 slides that you want to cover in 20 minutes, there is no way that there'll be time for that kind of interaction. And so that's why I encourage you, think about how you want people to apply the knowledge that you're giving them in the training. We're all committed to this prevention effort. We know how important it is, but it can't just be about our talking head. All right. So I'm going to talk about the core communication features that I believe have the strongest impact on the training. And in order to give us enough time, I'm not going to go through these in any detail. I just want to give you enough so you know what we're talking about. The first major competency is credibility. And the way you build that is not by handing someone your CV or not talking about all the things that you've done, but by making sure that they know that you've got the expertise to cover the content that you're covering. I know Dorothy does a nice job of essentially telling a story before she gets started. Trainer caring is also really important. You'll see that I'll argue that the trainees don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And that becomes a critical point in getting them engaged and getting them to use your content. From there, we move into trainer concerns. And for those of you that have an educational background, the work in teacher concerns actually goes back to the late 1970s. But I think that by sharing just a couple of key elements about concerns, you can actually start having even more of an impact than you're already having. Then we'll move into what's called immediacy. We'll look at both verbal and nonverbal, then clarity, and then finally content relevance. Are there questions thus far? If anybody's got them, please don't hesitate to post them to the website. We okay? Now, I know a lot of you still have your hands up because of when Livia had asked you to try it. So if you want, why don't you go back up there and toggle those off so that I know that if you do have a question, I'll look for the hand. Thank you so much. All right. So let's look at credibility. Ultimately, the way you build credibility is through your knowledge, through your expertise, and through the disclosure. So if all you're doing is following the manual, you're not personalizing any of the content, you're actually going to lower your credibility as you go through. So what I'm going to ask you to do is think about the successful trainings you've done and the failures or the times when things weren't maybe as successful as you would have liked them to be, and think, what were you doing at that point that made the difference, okay? So think about how you're building credibility through disclosure. Again, trainees don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so the way you build caring is not by asking the trainees to sit in a circle, hold hands, and sing kumbaya. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about being empathetic, showing them understanding, and then being responsive. So Barbara wants to know if I can explain more about what I mean by trainer concerns. And the short answer is yes. And your timing is perfect. The next slide will actually get into that for you, okay? So hold off on just a second, Barbara, and I'll make sure you understand the dimensions of trainer concerns. All right. But really, being responsive, I'm hoping what I just did with Barbara is an example of that, to let people know that you're listening, okay? So this is Barbara's answer. In 1969, Fuller did some original work in the classroom and looked at this developmental model. Her model actually plays out really well in the training environment, especially when you're dealing with prevention content. The argument is this. When trainers start, there's a concern about self. Will my trainee think I'm credible? Will I look smart? Will I say the right things? And it's fine to have those concerns about self. I might wonder if, you know, my zipper's up or silly things like that. We move developmentally then from self to task, and that is, do I have enough content? Do I have too much content? Do I have enough time? Am I using the right strategies? Will I be asking the right questions? And then finally you get into impact, and impact is, am I making a difference? What Fuller found in 69 was this. that it took teachers a while before they got to the place where they were really wondering whether or not they were making a difference. Are the trainees able to use this? Are they engaging it? And so, again, Barbara's asking the question, could you explain more? Oh, sorry, same question. It's my eyesight. Sorry, that's what happens when you get older. So it's fine to be high on self and task and impact, but if you leave impact out and all you're concerned about is your own credibility or the task at hand, I have an hour, how much can I cram into the hour, I think you're losing most of what it means to really be effective and getting the impact that we all want from the training. And that is, let's focusing on this concern, this trainer concern of impact. So it's probable that you're high all three of them the first time you're training something. But after a while, you should move to the place where impact is where you spend most of your time. Does that make sense, Barbara? All right. One of the elements that a lot of people point to as what makes for a really dynamic trainer, what we would call the Dorothy factor, is this element of immediacy. Now, you don't have to be as dynamic. You don't have to be bouncing off the walls, right, to get people involved. What you have to do is you have to decrease the physical and psychological distance between yourself and the trainees. That means if you're trying to train behind a podium, you're missing the boat. That means if you are in there and you are either intentionally or unintentionally setting up a situation where there's a barrier between yourself and the trainers, they will not feel that that immediacy. So some people call it expressiveness, some people call it enthusiasm, but in the literature you'll see it called immediacy. Okay? And we know that trainees are drawn to people that they perceive as being responsive, as competent, as caring. You see how all these pieces fit together. And we also know that trainer immediacy influences your credibility, whether or not the trainees are willing to talk to you, whether or not they're going to ask questions, and even whether or not they post positive ratings at the end about whether or not they enjoyed the training. I tell teachers at the university and professors I work with, if you're getting low evaluations, one of the easiest ways to improve the evaluations is with increasing your immediacy. Okay? So we know that what and how you say things in your training will affect those learning outcomes, both knowledge acquisition and knowledge application. And so you need to make sure that you're doing things both verbally and non-verbally to increase your immediacy. Because if you do that, you'll actually increase their motivation. Let me show you how it works. Again, we have verbal and non-verbal components. Some of the verbal components are things like praising people. Hey, nice job, or that's a great example, I didn't think of that. And you can use humor, but be careful of how you use it because it can also backfire. Simple ways of increasing verbal immediacy. Learn their names. Say things like, you know, Rebecca, nice job, or Barbara, nice job with the question. But you can also, in the immediacy process, you can also improve the clarity. As you increase your clarity, you also increase your verbal immediacy. You can ask trainees about their perceptions of the training. How is it going so far? All of those will increase the trainer immediacy. Now, nonverbal immediacy is what you usually think about when you think about the Dorothy factor, okay? But you can do that just simply by smiling, by leaning towards the people that you're training, using appropriate eye contact. And then again, I've talked about what you can do to decrease those physical barriers. So use both verbal and nonverbal immediacy, and you'll be surprised how you can impact those other competencies that I was telling you about. So here are some tangible behaviors. Prepare for each training in advance. You'll notice I was on the conference call today, I don't know, 20 minutes in advance. You can vary the pitch, the volume, the tempo, move around the room. Now, you can't see me in this room, but I'm all over the place, and Dorothy's trying not to get hit as I'm moving around. Learn the training names if it's possible, and it is because in most of the trainings we give people name tags. Use those. If you encourage their participation and really mean it, you can also do things like using we and our instead of mine or yours. Using those inclusive pronouns will increase that verbal immediacy. But whenever you can, try to avoid that talking head syndrome. Smile and really express genuine interest. And if you do that, you'll find that there'll be an impact on other areas of the training. All right, what people talk about or think about clarity, they usually think about it in terms of the presentation. So what does the verbal fluency look like? Or what are my examples sounding like? Or are my explanations sufficient? But understand there are two other kinds of clarity you need to care about. One is what's called structural clarity, and that seems like previewing for people where you're going in the training, summarizing at the end, being clear in the structure as you go through things. And then you've got the instructional or the process clarity, and that has to do with things like stressing important content along the way or responding to any of the deficiencies that may come up where they come back and they say things like, the trainees themselves, I don't know exactly what you're talking about there. Can you clarify that? Okay? That's what we mean by clarity. Now, of all the things I'm talking about, content relevance is the easiest to deal with because the best way to improve content relevance is ask the trainees how the content is relevant for them. It's really just their perception of whether or not their needs are being satisfied. So many of you online have been training for 10, 15, 20 years. And so as I put the training together, I thought to myself, what can I give them that would be value added? But I also realized that there may be many of you that are training for the first time. And so the content has to be relevant for you. All right. So there are theories out there that would explain this, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through all the details about expectancy value theory, but let me tell you this. If we can help the trainees connect, we've done a good job at communicating value. That is, ask them, how is this useful? How is this interesting? Is it important? And ultimately, is it worth their time? Is it worth their time and energy to do this thing that you're asking them to do? So what kinds of behaviors can you use to get content relevance increased? One of the things you do, use concrete examples. Explicitly state how what you're doing today should be something they should be using when they leave your training. You can link the content to other things that you've talked to them before. You can ask them, and this is my favorite strategy, just ask them to apply the content in their own lives. If you do that, you will find that they will be more engaged. They're more likely to ask questions because you're asking them not for a right or wrong answer, but more that you just want them to think about how what you're giving them applies in their life. And then ultimately, I'm a big fan of discussion. Yeah, if we had more than about 45 minutes for the training, we would spend a lot more time with that discussion piece. All right. Other things you can do, and what I've done is these are six strategies that you'll see in the literature when they say, here are specific things you can do to improve content relevance. This actually came out of a Department of Justice training that I had done maybe 2 or 3 months ago, where somebody in the audience had asked, can you give us specific strategies on what we can do? And so what I've done here is I've just built a slide for each one of these strategies that say, well, how do I use experience? Well, use analogies. Find out what their interests are. When I saw the diversity of where you were all coming from today, and I saw the differences in the types of schools, I got really excited about this. And so there's a lot of experience that we have as a group that you can draw on. Okay? That's just one of the strategies. You could actually present the worth to them. But be careful. Don't be preachy and don't talk down to them. Just ask them things like, why should anybody care about this? Or what difference will it make? Or what's in it for you? These are really easy, quick ways to get the information in. But note, if you've got a full hour's worth of training and it's just a talking head, you won't be able to get what you need. All right? Another strategy, future usefulness. Tell them that I know this may not apply right now today, but I guarantee you the next time that you see a couple arguing in the park, or the next time you pass somebody and you feel really uncomfortable with the kinds of conversations going on, you'll have the tools that you need to make the difference, okay? And ultimately, just ask the trainees, how does this apply to your future goals? What can you do? All right, need matching is something else you can do. Find out what their needs are. So when I do this training face-to-face, I usually ask the trainees, I say, tell me what some of your concerns are when you train. And then throughout this training, I try to say, okay, here's how you can deal with those issues. The last one is modeling, and modeling is just about you demonstrating the things that you're looking for. The more prepared you are, the more enthusiastic you are for the content, the more impact you're going to have, because people want to be part of that. And it all has to do with people approach those things they like, and they run away from things they don't. That's just based on Moravian's work a long time ago. All right.
I just had a question. I think it was like a couple of slides ago where you talked about identifying the needs and asking them for their needs. I'm just curious, what would your suggestion be, either based on your experience and I guess also Dorothy or other folks on the line, for those opportunities where the trainings last more than a day or you know they're going to be these reoccurring trainings, do you conduct or do you do like any type of like needs assessment, needs and resources assessment before you actually conduct the training?
You can do that, so you can customize it a little more. Actually, what I like to do is use those classroom response systems and use clickers and then ask questions as you go along. And so, you know, you can say, of these six strategies that we just talked about, which strategy seems to be the less clear? And then spend a little more time with it. But those work really well because, you know, the clickers, right, that people can use. I don't know, Dorothy, do you use anything different?
Yeah, no, I think there's a range and the time you have to work within should guide how extensive you can get into it. Because like Derek's saying, if you got an hour doesn't mean you get to skip this section. Doesn't mean you get to, well, I've only got an hour, so it means, okay, instead of spending, you know, if I got a whole day, I may be able to spend the first hour doing some sort of team building or rapport building or kind of assessment within the room. If I've only got an hour, maybe I've only got 5 minutes. So maybe I'm going to use the clickers and ask three or four questions. We do work with, you know, folks as far away as Alaska where it's going to be ongoing work, in which case we'll go up and spend a week in advance to understand the different needs they have and how we make it relevant and how they're wanting to connect and the different obstacles. So the point I want to even pull from your question is whether you have an hour or whether you're going to be seeing someone on a college campus over the course of 4 years or the course of a semester-long course, that just determines how much time you get to spend doing some of these things, not whether you do or not.
Right.
I see. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Buffy.
You bet. And so that last piece is really all about shared control. Give them a choice. There are times when I'm working with a group and I can look out there in the audience and I see, you know what, there's a deer in the headlight stare out there, and no matter how dynamic that I'm being, they're not engaged. That's a perfect opportunity to ask a question. And even if you don't have clickers, use the old-fashioned one. Ask them to raise their hand. All right? That'll work just fine for you. All right? So there are lots of ways to make the content relevant, and this is just one of those strategies. Be careful that you're really not training content as you are trying to make a difference for knowledge application. You want them to use what you're doing. And so I want you to think, when you've got training, how much that you're giving them is actually just review? That you really don't have to go through all the content again. You can just review it. Maybe there's something fun you can do with a couple of quick Jeopardy questions. How much of the content is brand new? So even though the model that I'm using for this training is not new to people, I mean, it is new to people, you still know what some of those elements are. You've seen them before. When you're training prevention content like this, though, to encourage you all to think about how much the content actually needs to be unlearned. And then I know this is a big one for me. How much content is really necessary? How much is essential? You'll find that you have a whole lot more time in your trainings if you've actually sat down and said to yourself, what do you really want? They're walking out of the door an hour later or 3 hours later. What have you given them? What can they do? What do they know now they couldn't do when you started the training? And if you do that, it really changes the dynamic of what you're doing.
Can I jump in here for a second? This is Dorothy. Again, this piece of how much content needs to be unlearned, I think it's particularly relevant for our field because at the college level, I don't think you're ever going to walk into a group where it's a blank slate.
Exactly.
And they're not only coming in with a bunch of stuff they think they know, but it's stuff that they think they know intellectually and have an emotional response to. And so I just want to reiterate the point Derek's making about making sure you have adequate time. Because it's not just you're not only do you need adequate time to present the information, you need adequate time to do whatever process in terms of making it interactive, et cetera, but you also need adequate time to deal with some of the obstacles and resistance and process that's going to need to happen when you push on some of those old things that we're wanting them to unlearn. So I just want to kind of reiterate that in terms of planning, an hour can go really fast.
Agreed.
In this particular field, in this particular content, because of that one line of how much needs to be unlearned and how emotionally evocative it can be.
Let me give you one quick example. I want you all just to stare at this image for a second, and I want you to read it out loud to yourself, no matter where you are. Take a second to do that. And I think that every one of you will read this as rabbit in the hat. But in fact, that's not what it says. It says rabbit in the hat. Well, rabbit in the hat doesn't make sense. And yet, if the paradigm that people are using about bystanders that mom told me never to get involved, and I know if I get involved, I'm going to get even more hurt than what the participants would have to begin with, we're missing the boat. Do you see that? Here's another thing I want you to think about in terms of content. Is it clear? Is it optimal? Is it relevant? Is it essential? And then think about the sequencing. That's the middle part of that model. And so, again, when I think of optimal, it's making sure that the content doesn't go over their heads or isn't that you're talking down to them. When I talk about the content being essential, what I'm talking about is don't provide too much that it's just information overload. Okay? Here's the example of that. So you have a big sign here that says, caution, this sign has sharp edges. Do not touch the edges of the sign. That's what we do in our trainings. We give them all this stuff, and what happens is what we really want them to know, what we really want them to learn is that the bridge is out ahead or that we can all make a difference. We just all have to believe that we can, and we have to have the skills and the tools to do that. And so think about your training. If you're giving your trainees a sign that looks like this, it's probably not as effective as it could be.
Derek, just wanted to chime in here. There's a question from Rebecca Gordon.
Yes.
And she's asking about what strategies do you use to facilitate unlearning? So I don't know if you want to go back to that now or just keep it for the Q&A at the end.
Actually, let's deal with it right at the end because there's only a couple of slides left. But it's a brilliant question, and we will absolutely deal with it, Rebecca, because that. You have to know, first of all, that it has to be unlearned, and the only way you can do that is by engaging the participants to find out what they know that's wrong, okay? And I'll give you some strategies for doing that here in just a second, but that's a great question. All right, so I'm going to distill this down to just a couple of take-home points for you, right? You're walking out the door. What can you actually do in the classroom, in the training environment, that's going to make the biggest difference in terms of not just the core message that you're sending, but also in your delivery? How do you get to what I call the Dorothy factor, all right? Use signposting in your training to let people know where you are and where you're going. So using internal transitions or summaries, reviews, those are all really helpful, especially if you're doing training over multiple days. So at the end of the day, you can say, so today we're focusing on these things, or we focused on these things. Have a good night tonight. When you come in tomorrow, we're going to be dealing with these things. And then when they come in that morning, you do that again. Be careful not to go through nervous pacing. If you're new to training, the trainees will smell that blood. And so be careful about the nervous pacing in the room. When that happens, you have a tendency to refer only to those trainees that are paying attention and they're nodding and they're letting you know that they care, but you're neglecting the other side of the room. So make sure you use the whole room. Please don't train to your slides. If we were in a room, you will see right now that I'm not reading from the slides. I know this content well enough that I won't do it. And again, keep them clear. Try not to give them more than 6 lines and no more than 6 words per line. All right. So, essentialize that content. Think about the table of contents rather than the index. Whenever you can, try to bring in new resources. Maybe you've just read an article or you've been to a training yourself that you can bring in. Listen and respond to the training needs. In fact, even as I'm speaking, I know Dorothy's going through some strategies herself on unlearning. This is the value of doing joint training when you have the opportunity to do that. Okay? So we get back to the model, understand that this is the critical part. It's getting them to use the knowledge in the training. There's an example I can provide when we were first doing HIV, STD, and pregnancy prevention curriculum in the schools. And it seemed like every teacher, to the teacher, wanted to show the slides of chlamydia and gonorrhea and syphilis, and they wanted students to be able to distinguish between the slides. And I looked at her, or looked at them as a group, and said, why? Don't we want them to engage in the behaviors so they never have to see any of that firsthand? What can we do to get them to the behaviors, right? So it's all about that application. You can have a big impact in your training if you think about the caring element, the immediacy issues, and the credibility issue, all right? And then again, I talked about those six core areas: credibility, caring, concerns, immediacy, clarity, and content relevance. The question that's still pending, though, the one we want to deal with, is the one that Rebecca posed, and that is, what can we do when people come in and it's clear that the knowledge that they have is not only wrong, but it's so wrong that it can actually do more damage than harm? And Dorothy, you want to deal with a couple of those?
Yeah, I'll talk some about our field specifically, and then
please.
I don't know if Derek has some more general ones. Both through whether we're doing our own polling or just because we've been in the field long enough, we know there are a lot of myths and misinformation out there. And again, this is, Derek's got a different kind of expertise on this. This is kind of field specific.
Sure.
Not pulling from the same body of knowledge that Derek has. But first of all, we got to know what's realistic within the time frame that we have. And I think one of the pitfalls that we fall into as a field is if someone comes in with a deeply held belief that is wrong, and we have 45 minutes to do a full presentation in a class full of 50 people, us coming directly at someone's belief, even if it's wrong, with only 13 seconds to process it in front of a room full of people.
Bad idea.
And it is not only going to not accomplish what we want, it's going to do the opposite. It's actually going to very often dig people in into more resistance. Someone comes straight at you, and they don't actually have time to process it and work through it and work through their own values and their own lens. What happens is we dig our heels in, we get even more stubborn. So first is understand that a 45-minute training isn't the time to unlearn all of the rape myths. There's just not adequate time. However, we all work on college campuses. So we have 2-3-4-year relationships with these people. And in fact, sometimes, at least at UK, we have the 9-year plan. So we get, I'm just kidding, of course. When we've got that much time, then it's about going back to some of the earlier concepts that Derek talked about and bringing them into this context, which is, once I've got credibility with them, once I've built a relationship with them, once there's a kind of a connection of trust and empathy established, then it's going on a longer-term journey of unlearning with them. So it's meeting them where they are first, with really understanding they came by this misinformation, honestly. They didn't get it from the wind. Our culture is a culture that believes many of these myths associated with this issue. So understanding that, meeting them where they are, and then it's remarkable once you do that, once you meet people where they are without judgmentalness, which, again, as a field, in terms of how they, speaking to Derek's different communication strategies, when you go in and before you've even made a connection with people, you tell them how wrong they are and begin to judge them with no empathy for where it came from.
Bad idea. Bad idea.
Another bad idea. So I think it's really understanding how much time you've got to work with. When I've only got 45 minutes or even a couple of hours, honestly, a strategy that I use, and again, Derek can speak to whether this is worth anything or not, is sometimes I don't go directly at them. Sometimes what I do to correct misinformation is instead of directly telling them how wrong their information is, I, in fact, go and redirect them to the correct information. So instead of a conversation that says,
"That's brilliant.
You're wrong and I'm right," I don't even do the you're wrong thing. I just say, here's another way to look at it. Here's another redirection. So when they're going, the victim had it coming, instead of going, no, she didn't, no, she didn't, no, she didn't, I say, gosh, let's talk about how we could stop it from ever happening to begin with. And interestingly, one of the outcomes to a study they did here at UK was that redirection, that idea of instead of directly challenging the misinformation, redirecting them to a different way of looking at them or more accurate information actually resulted in less subscribing to that misinformation. So anyway, those are just some of the strategies to think about.
Yeah, and Rebecca, there's a couple others that I can give you, one of which is this. If you know that it's just one individual that it's coming from, you need to know, first of all, and you probably know this from your own experience, you don't want to call them out in front of everyone, anyone. Tell teachers this all the time. You start playing power with students, whether you're right or wrong doesn't matter. Same way with trainees. So what you can do is you can actually just invite them to be part of the process, and then you can deal with them and talk with them either before or after the training, right, or at your breaks. Another way to do this is you could do a special training just on what I call debunking the myths. You use the classroom response system so you're not pointing to any one person. So even once you've got, you know, you've got 50 people in the room and 49 people know what the right answer is or know what the proper approach is, what's appropriate, but there's one person. It doesn't matter who that one person is. You have that up there, and then you can give them a slide with the correct information on it or the most recent research. It really depends on your own situation. What works in Iowa may not work in California. What works in Kentucky may not work in North Carolina, as an example. Does that make sense? Did that help to deal with that? And I'll wait for Rebecca to come back in. But really, that unlearning is part of a process, and you do that as partners, not as I'm right, you're wrong. That's the easiest way to destroy your credibility, is to go in there with all the answers.
And it fills the room differently.
Yes.
The difference, and this is key, especially in our field, the difference between walking into the room and my lens is, as a speaker, I am going to convince them of my truth. That feels, and that's how I spent the first 10 years doing the work. I knew I was right. I knew too much of the violence was happening. I knew people needed to do things different. And I went into it, I've got to convince people of my truth. That fills the room in one way. An alternative approach is, it's my job to create an environment, to create a space where they can connect to their own truth, right? When I want to create a space that's non-judgmental, understands, and trusting people, if I give them the tools, they will actually connect to their own truth. And that creates a different space as a speaker, and ultimately,
absolutely,
when what you've been able to engage is intrinsic motivation, that they've connected to their own truth, to their own a desire to get involved, they actually walk away with something that's more likely to be applied when they leave than if I just went in and tried to do this externally imposed, here's my truth, and I'm gonna force it into you.
And when you move from that talking head into a world where you want it to be a partnership, you really can have a profound impact. Because it's not about what, you know, opening up their head, pouring in the knowledge, and closing it back up. It's about really wanting true behavior change, what this has been all about all along. And I'm going to argue, you know, I want to make sure there's still enough time here, but hopefully as you look through these six objectives, we've talked about the message-centric approach, what it means to be efficacious as a trainer. It's not about, you know, looking like Freud and talking like Einstein. I don't think I could listen to that anyway. But recognizing what those core communication features are, what you can do to truly get your trainees engaged, thinking about and asking questions about and doing things with your content, and then moving to the competencies and their engagement, ultimately you will find that you'll be able to communicate much more engaging training content just because of the attitude that you're bringing to the topic. So that's what I'm going to tell you. I'm sure all your content is great. I'm sure that you're already profound in your delivery. But if you really want to have that impact, move from training to focusing on those trainees. That's what the Dorothy factor is all about. It's not just how dynamic she is or how other trainers are when you look at them and say, that's really great, but I can't do that. The fact is you can do that, and you can see some of those elements that you could easily work into your training that doesn't require you to be someone that you're not.
By the way, the I pay him $5 a piece every time he says the door detector. Diana, you've got a really good question. Diana's asking that if you have presented ineffectively previously, how do you correct this and start over? So I want to touch on that and then let Derek touch on that as well. I not only present it ineffectively, but presented ineffective content for 10 years. And when I've found tremendous power in owning that. Because it's interesting, this in many ways connects back to Rebecca's question of how do you unlearn,
mm-hmm.
and ties back to some of the themes Derek talked about, or how do you help folks unlearn, and talk to Derek about that idea of establishing credibility and that connection and the immediacy, and wrapping all of those things into one, Diana. I have very regularly, maybe even most often, I will start a presentation with, here are ways that I did this wrong in the past, and I have considered, and my hope is, as I share the ways that I have done this wrong and the ways that I've reconsidered, that you might reconsider your previous relationship with this issue. And that idea of, like, I have not had feedback where folks have said to me, you are, that I have lost credibility, or that being perceived as kind of, like Derek talked about, that perception of expertise, confidence,
yeah.
what was the word,
mm-hmm.
Because I've owned stuff. Like I've made mistakes in the past, and how I did that, I think, lent me credibility, in fact.
Absolutely.
Because what I'm asking them to do is, I'm asking you to rethink some stuff, and let me do it first. Let me show you how I've done things wrong. So, Diana, I wouldn't have any problem in the world with you going in going, gosh, I'm reconsidering how I present because I feel like I haven't
yeah.
done the job I wanted to have done.
In fact, if you talk to most experienced trainers or experienced faculty members, I'm starting my 17th year at UK, and I would love to bring all of my students in for the first 10 years I've been teaching and apologize to them. Say, I'm really sorry, right? Because initially I'm thinking I have to show you just how smart I am and everything I know, when in fact I needed to be responsive to their needs and figure out what they really needed to know, what they really needed to learn or unlearn, and then move from there. So don't be apologetic, but on the same hand, I agree with Dorothy. Don't be afraid to own it.
And Diane, I also want to validate, as a field, we have neglected this issue. As a field, we have been focused on the message and have neglected the messenger. When DOJ, OVW said to us, you need to pick a topic for the webinar, I looked at all the list of topics on this issue that we could have presented on. And I ended up on this one because I feel like it is the most often overlooked. And yet it is foundational to our success that as a field, we take more seriously the role of the messenger. So I want to validate your question, Diana.
Absolutely.
And as a field, we weren't even required. My first 10 years as an educator, I never once had a supervisor that said, are you an effective messenger? Are you an effective trainer? No one evaluated me. No one trained me. They just said, here, go do this content. And so in addition to that's how you could handle it in front of a group of, gosh, I'm doing things differently, in terms of structuring our work time and understanding that us effectively delivering a program doesn't just mean building a PowerPoint presentation and outline. It also means that we practice. And we practice the elements that Derek has laid out for us. We practice in front of our peers. We critique ourselves. We critique each other. You want to see how good you are at the things Derek is talking about. Here's what I challenge you to do. Take your standard presentation, your 50-minute that you do, and videotape yourself doing it. And then watch it. And have in front of you Derek's PowerPoint and the list of things. And rate yourself. And it will be astounding to you how you can go, oh, gosh, I was really good at the immediacy. I really felt myself there. But, boy, I didn't open it up once in terms of, you know, getting their buy-in. Or, gosh, I spent no time on credibility. Whatever those things are. So I encourage all of us to, as a field, to take these things and really spend some time applying them in our work.
Well, I'm looking at the clock, and it looks like it's 3 p.m. Livia, are there any additional concerns that you want to raise or any other questions you have? Really appreciate this opportunity.
It looks like we have one more question coming in from Luann. And she's asking, have you ever lost credibility using this approach? We have worked with some very entitled students who may tune out. And I know this takes practice, but this is also a reality effect that she's experienced.
It's more likely using this approach to engage those students than not. Generally speaking, when I have a group of entitled trainees, whoever they are, that somehow they already know all the content, they've already been there and done that, that coming in there with the, well, I'm going to show you how my approach is unique, or, you know, if I come in there as that talking head, I'm more likely to lose that group. So, honestly, what Dorothy's saying is right. It is about the messenger, but it's because the messenger cares about what they're delivering. It's a gift that you're giving to the trainees, and it's about them, not about you, right? But the focus on this webinar is really on what can you do to engage those trainees so you can have that impact.
And, Luann, it's also about, make no mistake, even when I'm up there saying, let me tell you the ways that I did this wrong in the past, I do not do it as a fumbling, sheepish, I'm so embarrassed. I speak with, I know my room, I know my content, I'm an expert in this field, and even as I'm owning my mistakes, I'm doing it with a clear sense of credibility. I'm an expert in this. Let me show you where we've screwed up. So I'm not suggesting we go over there and are blushing and sheepishly kind of going, oh,
not at all.
Because I can say I've done it wrong and still be presenting as a competent, I know what I'm talking about, I'm the expert in the room kind
That's
of
it.
Thing. So, but it's a real fine line because there can be someone who does know, who's not saying they did anything wrong and they haven't prepped enough, they're not prepared enough, they're too tied to the PowerPoint, they're pacing like Derek talked about, and even though they may know it and they're not admitting they said anything wrong, they can lose the room in the way that you're talking about in terms of credibility because they're not coming across as competent and expert. So that's sometimes not just about what you're saying, but the confidence and how prepared you are and when you actually are presenting information.
When I see people getting in trouble, it's generally because they think that PhD or that MD makes them bulletproof, and they think that that's all they need for the credibility, when in fact that's all they need until they speak. And the minute they've said their first word, that's when they'll start losing credibility. So coming in there, again, there's no substitute for being prepared, for knowing the content. But again, I think you just take that next step and think about, what do they know when they're walking out that they didn't know before? What can they do now? And how can you help them get there? Luann, did we answer the question? Looks like we did. Great. Anything else?
And I forgot to ask you this, Derek, earlier, but do you mind if we also provide folks with your contact information should they want to kind of follow up with you with anything?
Not at all. Happy to give it. In fact, I'll give you the UEA. Before I had the PhD, they used my first initial and my middle initial. So even before I had it, it was Dr. Lane. My middle name is Ray. So people responded to my email in a hurry. So you can also use drlane@uky.edu, but Derek.Lane will get it to you as well. Happy to answer anything. You bet.
Thank you so much, Derek, and thank you so much to Dorothy for the wonderful discussion today. And then also thank you to the participants for the really thoughtful questions that were posed. And so we do have a few more minutes, so if folks haven't have any additional questions, please take the time to pose them now. If not, we're just going to segue right into the acknowledgments. Great. So just again, thank you to all the participants. Thank you to our funder, the U.S. Department of Justice, Office on Violence Against Women, as well as our colleagues at the various organizations and institutions, East Central Oklahoma University, the Kentucky Domestic Violence Association, the Mississippi Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So thank you to everybody for making it happen. And again, just a brief reminder that all the materials will be, they're already made available on the calcasa.org website, and the recording will be up in a couple of days, along with the chat transcript. So having said that, we look forward to seeing everybody on Tuesday, October 25th, not the 23rd. So it'll be Tuesday, October 25th for the next and final web conference. Thank you, everybody.